Welcome to PRN, Pause, Renew, Next, a podcast about soul care, scripture, and stories of faith. I'm Jenny Detweiler, and friends, I'm so thankful that today's guest, Fran Ballingy, could join me for this conversation. I've known Fran for a very long time. Back 20 years ago when I was in graduate school to become a counselor, and she already was one. She has years and years of experience as a licensed counselor. And in today's conversation, we're talking about children who are neurodiverse or who come from hard places and early life trauma, and the differences that that creates in the brain, behaviorally, and relationally. Now, Fran comes to this conversation as a licensed practitioner who works with children and families, but she also adds her own personal experience with this issue in today's conversation, and I'm so thankful for all the wisdom that she shares. This information may be helpful to you as a parent, or a grandparent, or even a sibling. Or it may be helpful to you if you work with children in any capacity, teaching, coaching, ministry, etc. But even if it's not applicable directly to you, I guarantee it's applicable to somebody in your close proximity. And this may help you better understand where they're coming from. So I hope you'll stick around for the whole episode. So with that, let's jump into the conversation. Well, Fran, welcome to the podcast. I'm really glad that you're here. Would you like to share a little bit about yourself, whatever you want people to know?
My name is Fran Ballingy. I am a licensed clinical mental health counselor. I think I remembered all those letters correctly. I'm an adoptive mother, and I've been married to my husband, Aaron, for 22 years. A long time.
So just for fun, I'm going to share with the listeners that I knew you 20 years ago.
Yes.
Speaking of being married and living a long time. But back before I was a counselor, when I was in graduate school, and you were a counselor, and you sort of mentored me in a way because I worked in the front office of the practice where you were working. And I got to learn a lot from you. So it's really fun to get to talk to you now, also as a practitioner and an adoptive mom. Okay, before we jump into the nitty-gritty of all the stuff we're going to talk about today.
Yep.
I want to talk about your fascinating hobby, which is, I don't even know what to call it, mosaic making?
Yes, mosaics. Yeah.
Okay. Tell me how you got into that.
Yeah. So I regularly change my hobbies. I have tried watercolor, which was not very successful, block printing, sketching, loom knitting.
Oh, neat.
Yeah. And so sometimes hobbies cycle back through. I had tried mosaics probably in my early 30s, and so it just cycling back through. But I think it stuck because it's just a powerful medium for me to be able to process feelings as I work. The first one that really took hold that way is about 10 years ago. And I had all my supplies. I was ready to put together, but the design wasn't come together exactly. So I kind of put it away. And then I had a conversation one day with a parent who was really worried about their kiddo being so depressed. And when I was looking at the kid and talking with her, I'm like, I think it's medical, not mental health. And so I, you know, like, oh, you should call the doctor and you should use these words to describe what is happening. And she did, luckily. And then later that day, I heard that the child had gone to a children's hospital and was going to be there for a long stay. It really rattled me.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I get home and I have my mosaic supplies nearby and my design idea just kind of clicked. And so I started putting it together and I found that I could just kind of like get to a monotonous part and grieve a little bit and be scared for this kid and for my kids who weren't that far apart in age, and then come back out and reassess, like, do the colors match? Is the pattern flowing? Whatever. And then dip back into grief and then out again. I think that's why it stuck so long, because it just gives me room to do something creative and deal with hard things.
So for people who are listening who maybe can't visualize what we're talking about.
Yeah.
You do it like stained glass. I mean, they're pieces of glass. It's not like little pieces of plastic or like pebbles or something.
No. So I take stained glass scraps from other stained glass artists. I take an old frame that was recycled from somebody. There's clear glass on it. Then I add a design with stained glass and then grout it dark So it kind of has a stained glass feel.
Yeah. That's so cool.
Yeah.
It's really cool. That feels overwhelming to me, but I really would have to like see you do it to get the whole understanding, but it looks so cool.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about needing to use your emotions, what I thought you were going to say was anger, because I can picture like
breaking
smashing
things.
The glass, you know, and how good that would feel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating. So both of us personally and professionally.
Yes.
Understand a lot about neurodiversity, kids that come from hard places, trauma, and resulting big behaviors that come with that.
Right. Yep.
I don't know that the average person listening really understands what that means or what that's coming from. I think if you have a particular background or you've been trained in certain things, you might understand what all that means. And we'll describe more of that as we go today. Sure. But would you tell some of your story about how you came to know so much about these topics?
Sure. Sure. So my first job in public mental health was with school-age children, kindergarten through eighth grade. And mostly kids who were adopted or in foster care. A lot of children who were in poverty. And when you start working with children, you learn pretty quickly that trauma is just a big part. I guess I always just wanted to know more, how to be helpful. So I started doing research. I don't remember what year, in the early 2000s, I went to a training at Barium Springs, and it was about the impact of trauma and brain development. And it fascinated me, like that our brain can wire differently if you've had trauma in early childhood. And I guess that started it off. Part of our brain that is responsible for fight flight actually gets bigger because of trauma.
Uh-huh.
And then that shows up in more fight flight type of behaviors. Yeah.
So I think it's really interesting because the information we have now has changed so much in the last couple of decades compared to the way we would have been talking about this in the 90s or even the early 2000s. There's so much more information about trauma, about neuroscience, and a lot about neurodiversity right now, too, which is really expanding and helping us understand more about where some of this stuff is coming from. And do you want to talk a little bit about personally, too, how you've come to know more about this subject?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So, again, I was very interested in kid behavior, learning about sensory processing, learning about brain development. And then I became a parent. And when my children were little, we dealt with a lot of meltdowns. So I would learn about sensory processing for work. And then when my son was old enough to talk, he would start asking for soft clothes or certain food preferences. I remember coming home from work one day. He came into the kitchen and he took off running as fast as he could through the kitchen with his head down. And he hit me in the gut with his head like a bull, like you'd imagine. And I didn't get mad at him. I just went, oh, okay. Yeah, I know what this is. It's sensory processing difference. And I know what we can do. We're going to go, you know, get an evaluation with an occupational therapist. So everything I learned at work, I would apply at home. Things I learned at home, I could take back to work and say to a parent, you know, oh, maybe try this. Maybe this is what's going on. Get more training for work. Take it home, practice back and forth. It's just been a skill set that has grown over time.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm not going to make it be all about you. I'm going to share a little bit too, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So I have an adopted child that has some of that. And I also have biological children that have some of that. Some ADHD, one diagnosed and one who's not, but I know also has ADHD. And he's a teen now, but when he was younger, well, even to this day, certain clothes, he won't wear them. Mm-hmm. It has to be a certain kind of feel. It can't be too tight. Yep. It has to feel just right. So he's very specific about that. And I would call it sensory seeking because it's like two of my children don't know where their bodies end and the next person's begin.
Oh, yeah.
And so they touch people too hard or get in personal space. And now I know, I mean, it still is annoying sometimes, especially for my other children who are like, ah, he's on top of me.
Yeah.
But it's really helpful to know that what their brains are doing is sensory seeking. Like they need more stimulation, yeah. not less. And so they're constantly seeking that in many different ways. But one of them is like physically with their bodies. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's so much good information coming out these days about neuroscience, trauma, brain wiring. Because you work with this population, and particularly, actually, before we do that, you want to talk about the population that you see these days, like the kind of ages that sure. you work with?
So currently, I work with children birth to 10. I do go a little higher under certain circumstances, but mostly birth to 10 and then their parents.
Yeah. What is some of the helpful information that you find many people in general, parents in your office, or other professionals misunderstand or don't really know enough about when it comes to kids that have big behaviors?
I think we've been taught for generations that behavior is willful, it's purposeful, maybe it's driven by a need for attention, and that attention seeking must be terrible and awful. But I think the biggest is that behavior should respond to rewards and punishments, or
yes, like that. If people are going to change their behaviors, we can do that by giving them rewards or by, you know, taking points off of their stuff, and somehow that's right. going to change. But if they don't have control over it,
right,
because it's a brain issue, then that isn't really going to help.
Right. I don't think that we understand collectively as community that a lot of the big behavior is nervous system driven. And it's a stress response. So kids are going into fight flight, or they're going into a functional freeze state. And in those moments, they don't have full control over their behavior. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think parents do get that when they see the thing that sends their kids there, and it's clear to them. They get it.
Right.
But there's so many things that can trigger a child going in to a big behavior state or shutdown that we don't see if we don't know how to look for it. And I think then parents just make assumptions. They're being willful, or they're being manipulative. They just want their way. And I just don't think behavior's that simple.
Right. Yes. So speaking of that, I remember about, I guess, whenever I knew you before, so 20 years ago, you were doing a training, or the people at the practice were doing a training in Love and Logic,
yes.
which is a lot on doing, and it's helpful information yeah. for neurotypical children. Like if your child acts out in a certain way, then you give them a natural consequence that goes yes. with that, and then they will learn from that yes. difference. So tell me how these kinds of issues, how maybe that wouldn't work so well, and what you might want to do instead, or other ways to think about parenting. Does that make
sure,
sense?
Sure, sure. One of the things I liked about Love and Logic is they say give your child a task they can handle,
uh-huh.
and then hope they fail, meaning give them the opportunity to learn from it.
Uh-huh.
So I really like the give them something that they can handle, because it puts it on us to understand where they are developmentally
uh-huh.
and what they can manage. One of my struggles with it, though, was the if your child messes up, send them away until they can calm themselves.
Right.
And for me, in my house, if I were, you know, when the kids were younger, say, uh-oh, you got some room time coming or whatever, and expect them to go away and calm themselves, it wasn't going to happen. It was going to escalate the problem much higher.
Yes.
Especially my one that struggled so much with separation anxiety, that if he needed a space to calm, it had to be a space that he and I went to together to calm.
Uh-huh.
Because he could not do it alone.
So Karen Purvis calls that time in before time out.
Yes.
Because what we're really talking about is regulation. So if some kids can go and regulate themselves by themselves,
yes,
these kids may more likely need co-regulation to help their bodies yes. calm down.
Yes, co-regulation.
Right. So being distanced from other people actually might make them feel more scared and more upset.
Right.
But being with them can help them calm
yes.
down. Now that, let's just be honest, as a mom can be really difficult sometimes, isn't it? Because
is.
Sometimes they've done things that make us upset too,
it
and
is.
We may not want to sit with them for
right.
a little while.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So talk about that. How did you help yourself do that?
Oh, that's a hard one.
Sorry.
Sometimes I haven't done it well. Sometimes
uh-huh.
my kid's losing their mind and I've said, go to your room
uh-huh.
in a harsh way, and then they lose their mind more, and then I'm yelling and mess it up. And then luckily I have a spouse who can intervene and say, you're not going in there to help him because it's not going to be helpful.
Uh-huh.
And he can take over and help my kid and help me to get calm. And then I go back and apologize and fix and we move forward. But I've tried to cultivate some practices over the years to help me. If I mess up and I scream and yell and I'm too harsh, I take the time out to understand that and say,
yes,
what in the world was going on with me? What got triggered with me?
Uh-huh.
And I take time by myself.
Me too, that. Girl. Me too. This is a work in progress, isn't it? It is a work in progress. All parenting is a work in progress. And this is another form of that.
Yeah.
But I'm also thinking about what you said before, as far as giving them a task that they can actually accomplish. And noticing their skill set and what they're able to do and what they may need help doing.
Yeah.
And I remember there also from Karen Purvis, I think this came from, I don't know where it came from, but it talks about to err and repair is better than never to have erred. Because if everything goes right the first time, you're not making any brain headway. You're not making any new pathways. But if something doesn't go right and they have to learn.
Yes.
And try harder, or have you come alongside them so that they can learn? Or even when we mess up with our kids and have to do some repair work, you know, there's like new connections that are being built there. So who are the professionals or the information that you've gone to, or like the podcasts that you've listened to that have been really helpful in understanding all this stuff?
I'm a big fan of Stephen Porges' work, The Polyvagal Theory. I've enjoyed Bruce Perry's work. I listen to Robin Goble, who's a psychologist. She pulls a lot from Stephen Porges and Bruce Perry. Her book, The Raising Kids with Baffling Behaviors.
Something like that.
The Baffling Behavior Show is her podcast. I really like that.
Can I stop you there for just a second?
Yeah.
Okay, I've listened to her podcast just a little bit.
Yes.
But I have not read her book. So she talks about, in trying to make this make sense to our kids, she talks about like what an opossum brain and like an owl brain and all this stuff.
And watchdog.
Yeah. Tell me what that means. Can you explain all of that?
Sure. Our owl brain means that my nervous system is regulated. So my parasympathetic rest and digest is what we used to call it, is in charge. I can learn. I can think. If I have a problem, I have the bandwidth to look at it and deal with it.
And be able to connect with other people.
Be able to connect with other people. Yes. So it doesn't mean I'm calm. It means regulated.
Yeah.
I am in charge of my behavior.
So that's the owl brain.
That's the owl brain. The watchdog brain is a representation of our mobilization responses. So sometimes we say that's fight flight. It's not just fight flight. Actually, so it's our sympathetic nervous system is being activated. My sympathetic nervous system can be activated and I can still be regulated. So when kids are moving and they're loud and they're laughing and they're getting along with their siblings or friends, we call that play. And that is, would be the watchdog and owl together.
Yeah. Okay.
And then the possum responses are immobilization responses. So if a kid stops talking or stops making eye contact, or curls up or moves away from you, that's a possum response.
So like playing dead is why they're calling it a possum.
Yes.
Yeah, looks like we're shutting down a little bit. Like we're not fully engaged anymore.
Yeah. So a regulated possum response, owl and possum together, would mean I can sit quietly at my desk at school, or I can sit in my favorite chair and read a book, right? They're low energy states. Yes. But a dysregulated possum is shut down or freeze.
Yeah.
So if a child in that state's not speaking to me or not answering a question or not doing what I ask, it's not willful. That's they can't in that moment.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really helpful. Thank you. Another one I've seen you on Facebook talk about a lot is Mona Delahook. Is that how you say her name?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like her too. And she draws a lot from Stephen Porges' work of the polyvagal theory.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Anything else you think people don't understand or that get misunderstood a lot about these kids?
I think a lot of it is not understanding development. So how we grow and change as a human. So, you know, parents will come in very upset, like, my child is not obeying me. They're not doing what they're told. And I try to think of that skill of doing what you're told is not the skill for today that's in front of me. That is something that we're working toward. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm not going to demand that my child do something they can't developmentally do just yet. But I'm going to help them develop that skill over time.
Yeah.
So, I think that's one of the things that we get wrong. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the word that's come into my mind that I would probably use to describe that is scaffolding.
Scaffolding.
Like, this kid can't get up to the second story yet. We're going to have to build a scaffold to help him get up there. Mm-hmm. And some of that is the brain developing.
It is.
And some of that is helping me helping them get the skills to do the things that I'm needing from them.
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, following directions, doing your chores, telling the truth. These are all
telling
big
the truth.
Things.
Yeah.
I think, so not just scaffolding, but I think, especially with telling the truth, we don't always understand the developmental skill that our child is working on when they're struggling
with
that.
Yes.
So, you know, I think most of us for preschooler, we understand that they're going to tell stories that are very exaggerated and probably don't always feel the need to correct that, but that need to tell a story, try on a behavior, that continues for a long time.
Right.
Yeah.
So I find myself too easily probably broadly categorizing things that may not be true for all populations, but I'm going to say it seems to me in the things that I'm beginning to understand about these populations of people, people whose brains work a little bit differently, not badly, but a little bit differently, or who come from early childhood trauma, there can be parts of their development that are just completely on track.
Yes.
And other parts that may be far behind.
Yes.
So sometimes we might be talking to a 12-year-old and think this child is completely at a 12-year-old level.
Yep.
And other parts of them may be at a 6-year-old level.
Yes.
But teachers don't know that when they're requiring 12-year-old skills. Parents don't always know that when they're requiring them to act like a 12-year-old, not a 6-year-old.
Right.
So different parts of the brain and different developmental things can be coming online at different times. And that could be true for all of us to an extent.
I'm sure. And then if you are dysregulated, then your ability to act 12, even if you can most of the time, it's not there when you're dysregulated.
That's right. I do not act 42 when I'm dysregulated.
Either.
Not at all. When I'm melting down with my child.
Yeah. I've done that. For sure.
One other thing I wanted to talk to you about is, you know, both of us have had the opportunity in life to experience in real life the things that we're also helping other people with.
Yes.
Which is a blessing and a curse, but mostly a blessing. And also, both of us have worked part-time for a long time so that we could balance out our professional and personal lives.
Yes.
For different reasons. In what ways has being able to balance, well, I don't know that balance is the right word. I don't know what the right word is. But being able to do part-time work and also be at home some, how has that been helpful? And in other ways, how has that been challenging?
It's been helpful to be more available to my kids when they needed it more. I actually took a leave of absence for an entire school year because my son went through a period of burnout and was homebound for a while. For a school year. And so, and by the way, you don't get too homebound because your kid wakes up one morning and goes, Mom, I'm trying my best and I really just can't do this right now.
Yeah.
it happens behaviorally. That kid shows they just can't get there. You know, being able to work in a profession that allowed that flexibility gave me the room to come home and stay and just try to figure out what was happening with him, why we were seeing such big behavior and big struggles and more meltdowns and more fear. It gave me the room to practice some of the skills that I had read about and knew only in theory. hope this isn't too off track, but one of the things I had learned from Bruce Perry that behavior that is re- rhythmic and repetitive is regulating.
Yes.
So during that whole season of burnout, you know, my kid's having a hard day and I would say, hey, let's do your math. And he would take off running as fast as he could. And I mean, I knew he was in distress. He's struggling. So we'd go outside and get the baseball or the basketball and just throw it back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And I knew in my mind, I'm not just playing baseball with my kid. I am helping him heal. Right? We're trying out what is rhythmic and repetitive.
Yeah. And, you know, I had a guest on a couple years ago, Melissa Corkum, who also is an adoptive mom who does a lot of work. She does the Safe and Sound Protocol and things like that.
Good stuff.
And she talked about it, the same thing, but she called it the three R's. Repetitive, what was it? Rhythmic, and relationship. If you can do it in relationship, it helps even more. So that's what you were doing.
That's what we were doing.
Yeah, he can do it by himself, but it's better if you do it with him because that helps even more.
Yes.
Yeah.
Throw it's the good. Ball high, I throw the ball high.
That's
right. Throws it low, I throw it over and over and over, even if we didn't do math.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I couldn't have, like, just done that part-time.
Right.
I needed to be home full-time to make sense of what was happening with him, to make sense of what was happening with me, because I came very frightened and it was scary to see my kid fall apart as much as he had, and gave me room to try things that I just knew in theory, to help.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, I guess the big thing is when I talk about my kids being dysregulated, they both dysregulate in different ways. One's very external, you're never going to miss it. One's internal, and you can miss it if you don't know to look for it. Trying to figure that out with them and trying to grow as a person and really understand them. Like, I am incredibly grateful for my relationship with my kids. I love them. I think most mothers say they love their kids. I really like them. And I think that these big behaviors, it's the place we visit. It's not where we live.
Oh, that's really good. Oh, that's really good. I'm really glad you said that. It's a place we visit, not the place we live. Can I just be honest with you? Was there a time it felt like you lived there?
Yes.
Okay.
The season of burnout. Again, kids don't just wake up and go, I am struggling in a profound way.
Right.
Right. It's running off and it is throwing things and it's melting down and it's, that whole year, especially the first 3 months, there was two specific circumstances under which my son could be out of my sight, or I could be out of his sight. I should say it that way. If he went to soccer practice with his dad, and if he went to Sunday school with his dad, I could be out of his sight. Otherwise, if he was awake, I had to be where he could see me. It was terrifying. Yeah, I mean, I prayed a lot and cried a lot and was pretty sure that I had been completely abandoned and it would always be this terrible and it would never get better. And yeah, it was, it was really hard.
Yeah. And I'm really thankful, grateful that you would say that and share that for this reason. I have been there too. And it does feel like maybe it's not going to get better. And maybe I've signed on for this really horrific thing that feels a little helpless, like what's going to happen. Right. But now on the other side of that, with all the skills that you gained and as they've grown and the skills that they've gained, it feels like now we visit there, but we don't live there.
It's not where we live.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. And that's really helpful, I think. Some people may be listening to this and being like, I don't have any idea what you're talking about. My parenting was never like that.
Right.
And other people may be like, I feel seen. These are not things that we talk about with other moms or at the PTO meeting, you know. Certainly not at homeschool co-op. We're not going to say these things necessarily. Or if we do, people might be like, oh, what's wrong with your kid? What's wrong with you? You're not parenting right.
And I have.
Why don't you try this?
And I have gotten that feedback before.
Doesn't feel good.
And it doesn't help my parenting. I did not become a more effective parent
right.
when I was told that I was the cause.
Right. Oh, goodness. People are so, quote unquote, helpful sometimes. Yeah.
Scared.
Scared.
And I'm sure that it felt out of control. They couldn't fix it either.
Yeah.
So it was easier to just tell me that I was messing it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of people who are parenting children with big behaviors do feel isolated.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in certain seasons when the behaviors might be bigger or when we don't yet have answers for why things are happening. Because how do you go to church and have your child behave? How do you go to school and have your child behave? How do you explain it when you go to Walmart?
Right.
Yeah, and there's a lot of judgmental looks or people that are trying to be helpful that aren't very helpful.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I totally took you off track. What you were going to say is that you love your kids and you like your kids.
I do. Yeah, and so you said a little bit ago something about it's better to have a rupture. That's not the word you used. And fix it than not.
Yeah, it's better to err and repair.
Err and repair.
Than never to have erred.
Yeah. Uh-huh. At the end of my son's burnout. So things are getting better. He's back in the classroom. I just felt like I needed to have conversations with him about, like, I'm not blaming you. This happened and you were having a hard time and that was your best. So I remember having this conversation with him one day. I said, which do you think would be better? Would it be better to have two people who never make mistakes with each other and they get along fine? Or would it be better to like mess up and have to talk about it and work through it and get to the other side? He pauses and he said, well, it would be better to mess up and fix it, because you could have two people who live completely different parts of the world and they never even know each other. Yeah, that was not the answer. But you're right. That is that's how we know each other and grow. And I was glad that he was seeing that there was, like, this had been a hard season and it was getting better, and that, you know, there was something positive on the other side.
Yeah, yeah. Is there anything else that you'd like to share that I didn't give you a chance to?
No. I can't think of anything else.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if people are listening to us today and they're like, this is fascinating, I would love to know more, what would you recommend?
I'm a big podcast person, so I really like Robin Goebel's The Baffling Behavior Show, like her show.
Okay, I'll link to that in my show notes.
Regulated and Relational. That's another podcast I really enjoy. And then Mona Della Hook's two books that she has written and Robin Goebel's book that she has written. Those are my go-tos. I recommend them frequently.
Okay, I'll make sure that I link to all those in today's show notes so people can go and check those out. That's really helpful. Thank you so much for coming
on
the podcast and sharing.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks again, Fran, for being on today's episode. I had such a good time catching up and talking with you, and I really appreciate your wisdom, both your personal lived life experience, as well as the knowledge that you share for others that you've learned professionally. Well, friends, if you have more questions, or if you've learned just a little bit and you'd like to know more, I hope that you'll go check out some of the resources that Fran talked about in today's episode. I will link to those in today's show notes. Well, that's all for today's episode. I'm Jenny Detweiler with PRN. Pause, renew, next. May you be encouraged on your journey with Jesus.